Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
Lee Kennedy, Leaper's Fork, and you are a distiller. I love it.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Thank you for being back, Tom. It's been a minute since I've seen you.
Always a pleasure to come see you. How did you start out? Were you like a little adolescent brewer?
Yeah, actually, yeah. You know, it's for some weird reason. You know, I've had a fascination with distillation going back since I was a teenager.
You were a baby bootlegger.
In essence, you know, initially what drew me to whiskey production was from a cultural heritage standpoint. You know, my family's Scots-Irish, and, you know, I've always been a history guy. So even, you know, as a high school kid, I was just kind of fascinated with the prospect of whiskey production and how that came from Scotland and Ireland over to the New World and all the rest of it. So as a 16-year-old, I built a little 5-gallon pressure cooker still. Went down to Sears and bought a 5-gallon pressure cooker and some copper condensing line from Home Depot, and went through a little 5-gallon bucket as a condenser, and in my mom's basement built a little still and had a copy of the Foxfire book, which is, it's a 12-volume series of books written by Appalachian State professor, I think, in the 40s. Mm-hmm. And one of the chapters in there was moonshining as a fine art. So I learned just enough to be dangerous and kind of scratch an itch. And
you didn't blow anything up.
Didn't blow anything up. Didn't poison anybody. And it was very kind of cautious. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was the kind of the seed of the passion that I developed for producing whiskey.
Were you using grains?
Yeah, absolutely. I was doing traditional
corn.
Yeah, using food grade corn. And we were using that time 50% sugar, which would have been a traditional kind of moonshine recipe. Obviously today whiskeys aren't allowed to be used. Sugar's not allowed to be used in making whiskey today. But anyway, so that was the foundation kind of me. It's a culmination back since I was 16 of sitting here today. So yeah.
But absolutely. Did you ever imagine at that point in time that you would become a career?
No, absolutely not. Actually, I took that little still to, I went to Auburn University and went down and I took that still with me. And I never used it down there. I remember I had a couple of speech projects where I would do kind of like a how-to speech on producing whiskey, and I'd bring that still in as a prop. But anyway, so I moved back to Middle Tennessee in 2000. And we moved to a farm in 2002 here in Williamson County. And at that time, you know, internet was around. When I was 16, there was no internet. So, you know, you could figure out how to build an atom bomb on the internet now. So, you know, there was literature that had been written on the subject from a home distiller standpoint. I just kind of would consume any kind of literature I could get my hands on. Plus what was on the internet just kind of really, I had the mental capacity at that point to wrap my head around what I call, you know, the backwoods chemistry of making whiskey. Mm-hmm. So it's really a chemistry project at heart, obviously. So that fascinated me as well, the fact that you could take three inert ingredients, being grain, water, and yeast, and a contraption, being a still, and make something flammable. You know, whiskey is a flammable consumable. It sounds really kind of crazy, but that kind of captures people's imagination, and it did mine too.
So you're bringing down alcohol content dilution, right?
Yes.
In the process.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. You know, obviously, the definition of whiskey, we do tours here every day, and we use the word whiskey on this premises every day, countless amount, many a times, but you know, the definition of whiskey is a distilled beverage made from fermented grains. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that, but you know, we're producing that alcohol during the fermentation process, and then distilling that alcohol off by its boiling point during the distillation process.
Okay, let's roll back in time. You're out of college.
Yes.
And you're still making your Moonshine.
Yeah.
What was the game shift? How and why did you become a distiller?
You know, I was in the financial services industry before this and had an independent retail shop with a couple of partners. And so all of my free time, other than fishing and raising my kids, mm-hmm. were messing around in the barn, running different whiskey grain bills, bourbons, Tennessee whiskeys. It was a major passion of mine from mm-hmm. 2002 up to 2009. Really, the shift happened, you know, the 08 recession, we all remember that, have bad memories of that, but I rode that out professionally, kind of got disillusioned with the industry I was in, and so I actually reached out to an attorney friend of mine in Williamson County in 2008 and asked him, you know, what would it take to create a whiskey distillery in Williamson County, Tennessee at that time? His answer was, you would have to get 40% of registered voters to sign a petition, it would go on a referendum ballot, and then there would be a vote on the zoning or the code or whatever in the upcoming election. So that's, I didn't have that much time on my hands. But fortuitously, about a year later in 2009, our state legislature, at the behest of some other local distillers who happen to be attorneys, they got a law change in our state. So
that was the major game
shift. That was the major game shift. Yeah. So, you know, I was toying with the idea of opening a distillery in 2008 seriously. And then in 2009, Heath Clark, you guys were down at company yesterday. Heath was with some other distillers, got together, lobbied some state legislators and got that law change. And it's really, you know, and we'll talk about it probably in a minute, but, you know, there's a renaissance in distilling in Tennessee going on right now.
And so up until that point, was it like the Women's Christian Temperance Union and whatnot that were the roadblock?
Yeah, well, yeah. If you look at Prohibition as a whole, you know, we're still dealing with the effects. When I talk, we talk about Tennessee distilling renaissance. There couldn't be a renaissance without a drought period, yeah. And that drought period was caused by American Prohibition, which in Tennessee, you know, in the South, we're a contradiction of terms. You know, we're, it's weird down here. But anyway, so, you know, most of the whiskey in the country has been made between the Ohio River in northern Kentucky and the Tennessee River in northern Alabama. But at the same time, it's where a lot of the Prohibition happened and all the rest of it. So Prohibition started as kind of an emotional appeal by the Women's Christian Temperance Movement, which, you know, after the Civil War and up around the turn of the century, men were spending a lot of time in saloons. Mm-hmm. Of course, the saloon of the day back then, it was the poor man's country club. It's where you went to get news of the day. It's where you went to get find job offerings, all the rest of it. But so anyway, politicians realized that they could capture this emotional movement. And so the Anti-Saloon League was really the teeth behind Prohibition. So they took the emotional movement created by the Women Christians Temperance Movement and kind of politicized it. So in Tennessee, the Anti-Saloon League was very, very strong. If you weren't a member of the Anti-Saloon League as a politician, you were not getting elected in Tennessee.
Wow, that's powerful stuff.
Very powerful. So in Tennessee, we actually had some of the longest prohibition in the country. So we went into prohibition at the state level in 1910 versus 1920 at the federal level. Federal prohibition ended in 1933. Tennessee carried that on to 1937. Mm-hmm. So really you had a manufacturer's prohibition in essence in Tennessee from 1910 all the way to 2009.
Wow. And that, and the other disconnect we were talking about that yesterday was Jack Daniels.
Yes.
And that whole county is still
It's that's going back to that, you know, kind of contradiction in terms kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think Jack likes it that way. I think it's funny. You travel the world, and it's very funny that the world's single largest distiller is, you know, there's all that whiskey in that bottle comes out of Lynchburg, Tennessee, in the middle of a dry county. So mm-hmm. it's kind of funny, but yeah.
But somebody was saying they did a workaround where
yeah.
it is commemorative bottle. You can see,
yeah, there's a workaround. The state's did some forward-thinking laws is to help the distillers out. So I think Jack's kind of helped been able to mm-hmm. take advantage of some of the broader law changes that helps little guys like us, you know, to kind of sell bottles on site and commemorative and things like that.
That's really cool.
But until or from 1937 to 2009, mm-hmm. there were only three counties you could legally distill whiskey in Tennessee in, Coffey, Lincoln, and Moore. It just happens where Jack Daniels and George Dickel sit. Mm-hmm. And after Prohibition, the state allowed each county to vote on whether they wanted distillation back in their county or not. So the only three that voted that were those three that I mentioned, mm-hmm. till 2009.
Okay, so When did you open your distillery here?
Actually, I had my first meeting with Williamson County in January 2012 to kind of help me navigate this process of getting some law changes. So we had to change a law in the county. It took 3 years to do that. So we started construction in January of 2015. We got our building permit. And then we filled our first barrel in April of 2016. And then we opened to the public, where the retail cabin, in October of 2016. So we've been operating a little over 6 years.
Very cool.
Yeah.
When did I first meet you? Maybe 4 years ago or so?
I think it was, I think it was during the pandemic.
Okay.
I think so. It might have been 2 years ago. I think it was in 2020.
Yeah. So over that course of time throughout the pandemic, you've had some game shifters, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, what happened to us also, the pandemic was a blessing and a curse for us as well. So one thing it did, it kind of threw us into a more, we never shut down. We still produce whiskey. We didn't do tours, obviously. We kept our retail store open. And so for better or worse, during the pandemic, a lot of people were sitting at home drinking alcohol. And at the same time, people were also trying to support local small business. So I remember talking to my distributor and I think it was May of 2020, and he said that since March, almost every week had been like the week of Christmas. For alcohol distributors, the week of Christmas is like their big time. So they were running out of things like Jose Cuervo, Jack Daniels. So we were able to, people were wanting to support small business. So we kept our retail store open. We did curbside delivery, I mean, where we would take it out to the curb. And so we doubled our summer number in 2020 from 2019.
Wow.
Crazily.
Was there an evolution of what you made?
It increased our production kind of capabilities.
Mm-hmm. So more volume.
Exactly. So, you know, the production crew with me in the back in the still house, we were really able to bear down and focus on, and really kind of, some of my distillers, they were new at the time. And so with no distractions from tourism and all the rest of it, we were back there distilling. They were able to hone their craft at the same time, really dial in what we were doing as a distillery. So, you know, we weathered the storm fairly well, unlike a lot of other industries.
Talk to us about nuances of distillation process and philosophy and product. It seems to me, looking from the outside, you have more of a purist niche than a brewer.
Mm-hmm.
In that, the brewer has to every year come up with some new gimmicky beer, right?
It's funny. One of my distillers here, they'll say that brewers are quitters.
Right.
Because, you know, they get through the end of the fermentation process and things in. For us, you know, we get to the end of fermentation, then we go into distillation. I tend to disagree with that. You know, I've made beer also. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're interested in fermentation as a whole, you know, really everything starts with brewing. So to me, it's actually harder to make beer than whiskey. And the reason I say that is because fermentation is the end result, everything has to be hyper sanitized, clean. So, I mean, I had several batches of beer in my closet at home, you know, blow up because there's, you know, it wasn't done exactly right. So I feel like brewing is almost more, needs a different level of preciseness. Mm-hmm. So,
but I'm talking about the end product.
Yeah.
When you go in for a tasting room or whatever, every year they have some new.
Yeah, there tends to be that.
The gummy bear beer.
Well, and also I think that lends itself to, obviously, you know, R&D, research and development in the spirits industry. If you're aging products like whiskey and tequila and all the rest of it, you know, R&D in whiskey industry is 3 to 5 years to really see what's going on.
You don't even know.
Exactly. So a lot of that is preconceived notions, especially when you're starting out. So because of that, you may play around, but you're going to probably pick to a certain style or process of what you're doing and kind of carry that forward, which you end up building a big inventory of certain types of spirits. Like for us, we're still tweaking things. It'll probably take us a decade to dial things in. And as you know, Tom, look, we touch every aspect of the process. You know, we grow 75% of our own corn. Mm-hmm. The rest of the remaining grain bill comes from within 10-mile radius of the distillery. We are a true grain to glass distillery. We only make 25,000 gallons per year. Mm-hmm. Our big brother down the road in Lynchburg, they make 125,000 gallons a day. So different size and scope. You know, we're a batch distillery. It also gives us a little leeway. We can do some experimental things, and it makes us maybe a little more nimble. As far as the nuances, yeah, absolutely. You know, we put our grain bills up in our stillhouse for when our tourists come through. And I've had some riders come through, whiskey riders, like, man, I can't believe you put your grain bills up for everybody to see. And, you know, it's consumers, the easiest thing to wrap your head around are grain bills. What's the recipe? Which it all starts there, you know, like, but there's so many ways to affect flavor all the way through the process, which is the nuance. So I tell people, if somebody was going to, and I'd be honored if somebody was going to do this, hey, we want to try to mimic or replicate Leaper's Fork Tennessee whiskey or bourbon, they would in essence have to set up a distillery next to us. Like, we're making a terroir whiskey, same grain sources, same atmospheric conditions. They would have to the same equipment we're using. So all the things, your distillery becomes its own biome that has its own fingerprint.
Like the Angel's Share.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember in Isla, they would age their cask by the ocean.
Yes, and completely
so
different environment.
Take on the salty tang from the air.
And you could pick that up. It's so true. And same thing here. So trying to make a terroir whiskey, we want it's close to an expression of the surrounding from whence it came. So there's other things like what kind of steel you're using. We use a Scottish swan neck pot still. We're kind of hell-bent on pot distillation. Until the 1870s, almost all whiskey in the world was made pot still traditionally. So we feel like we're trying to be true to the traditional roots of whiskey.
But don't you have a column still out there?
So no, there's what we call a four plate purifier. Okay. So if you know, we kind of pull some of the playbooks out of single malt scotch, but that four plate purifier, or deflamator, whatever you call it, old timers in the woods would call that a thump keg or a doubler. Uh-huh. So it's taking that alcohol vapor, and as that vapor is traveling up through the trays in that purifier deflamator, the alcohol is becoming pure and lighter. It's not it doesn't act like a true column still. You're still getting the robustness of a true pot distillation, but you're able to go to the barrel in a single pass, a single distillation.
So it's ultimate refining.
Yes, it's a refining process.
Okay, one more curious question. The variables in flavor profiles and nuances, is it ultimately one Leaper's Fork whiskey that is it?
So our three main grain bills here are a rye whiskey, which is very limited. This year we did close to 100 barrels of rye. And then but the bulk of that is Tennessee whiskey and bourbon. We do a little bit of experimenting, but yes, it's kind of funny when you're making these different whiskeys, you know, we were going back to a biome or whatever, like every distillery has a fingerprint or kind of a backbone. The mark of a professional is consistency. So we try to do the same things every single day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like Groundhog's Day around here. People think working in distilleries kind of, it is fun. Yeah. It's like they have these grandiose ideas, but literally the daily grind of producing whiskey, that's where you get your consistency. So obviously every barrel, they make fun of me here for saying this, every barrel is like a snowflake. But there's still a common denominator in that whiskey you're making just from a consistency standpoint. So we actually use a blender, Ashley Barnes. Ashley is with the Spirits Group. She owns the company. She was with Four Roses for a long time and Buffalo's Trace before that as a blender. So she takes the pressure off of me from a blending standpoint. So she helps us profile every barrel that comes out of here. And then when we put our blending schedules together, we do very small batches here. Like, small batch is not a regulated term. So like small batch to Leaper's Fork Distillery is 10 barrels. Our largest batches are 20 barrels, and then we do single barrels. But anyway, a small batch for, you know, say Brown Foreman, maybe 1,000 barrels.
But you still have a scaled down palette.
Yes.
Of you can mix and match.
For sure. Find. Yeah. And there's an art in that. So, you know, we look at the industry almost in two different phases. You've got pre-maturation, which is taking grain, turning that into whiskey and putting it in a cask or barrel. And then post-maturation, which is what do you do with that whiskey once it's aged? So actually really helps us put our best foot forward as a distiller. And I'm not arrogant enough to say I have a lot of experience in pre-maturation, you know, making the whiskey, putting it in a barrel in ways that those preconceived notions that we feel like producing quality whiskeys. And then Ashley takes the burden off of us. Hey, let's put this whiskey together to make the best end product.
Question for you. Other than a palette to work from, I see a limited range of variables. And it seems to me the two that are most intriguing, a used barrel.
Yeah.
Like we talked about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Scottish Highlands.
Absolutely.
Using, and then yeast.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a trip.
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest, I think, for American whiskeys, we have federal regulations we have to work inside of. You know, the definition of bourbon from a production standpoint, Tennessee whiskey, whatever it means. So we've spent a lot of time, and I was in Scotland for a week and a half in October, and in London as well. We're going to be selling whiskey there in February, starting in London. But anyway, if you look at the world of Scotch, the universe is bigger because there's so much you can do with different barrels, different mm-hmm. cooperages. Mm-hmm. So in the States, because of we have to use a brand new
what?
Exactly, and the law stipulates actually a new oak container. It doesn't say char, doesn't say American oak, doesn't say American white oak. It says new oak container. It doesn't even say barrel. But because of that, with American whiskeys, because of that law, about 65% of the flavor profile of Tennessee whiskey and bourbon is coming out of the barrel. The barrel is an ingredient for us. So whatever you're doing with your grain bills and all the rest of it, a lot of that gets overshadowed by the barrel. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future. You know, obviously sustainability is a big issue right now. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see down the road if there are some changes to that law's been in effect, I think, since the 30s. Yeah. But and people ask, well, why is that law in existence? And I think the consensus is that we were in the middle of depression in the 30s, so it was a way for Congress to prop up multiple industries, you know, with that new barrel kind of law. Yeah. So
that's really interesting. So one of the questions is, what would the result be if you reused?
Oh, we do that here. You can make an American light whiskey.
What changes?
So I think the palate, how do I say this? I think the notion of Tennessee whiskey and bourbon would change for a little bit because people will be able to experiment more. I think the profiles of these whiskeys would change a little bit for the better. It would give distillers kind of a way to experiment more and give consumers more of a spice of life kind of thing. So, and it would actually make some very unique products. I mean, we play around here, you know, you can make an American light whiskey and go into a used cooperage. So we play around with different grain bills and go into and play around with different cooperages. American distillers are also doing a lot of barrel finishes.
So it's more a transformation of the flavor profile, but not necessarily a lowering of alcohol content.
No, no, no. And actually, you know, the definition of bourbon and Tennessee whiskey is bottled at 80 proof or more, 40% or more. So I don't see those things changing because that would really get into changing the definition of what bourbon and Tennessee whiskey is. It would change the profile, you know, if you're using used cooperage, but that may not necessarily be a bad thing, mm-hmm. you know.
Talk to us about yeast for a moment. So it seems like a real important variable.
It is. It is. And so and we had full transparency. We use a dry activated yeast here. We buy that out of Kentucky. We played around with probably 7 or 8 different yeast strains when we started. A lot yeast contributes a lot of nutty notes. So whatever a lot of fusels and congeners that are produced during the fermentation process are enacted by that yeast. So yeast is a big ingredient. For sure, a lot of mm-hmm. older distilleries, you know, they during Prohibition, master distillers would put their yeast in and they would take it home and put it in freezer boxes, or they would put it in a can that was waterproof and put it in a lake. So very proprietary information on the yeast side. New distilleries like us, we don't have those long lineages of yeast strains that go back, you know, 150 years kind of thing. So we were able to play around at the beginning. And it was really interesting to only change one variable, being the yeast, and see what kind of different profiles the distillate were taking on just with a change of one variable. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to see that. So we felt like we used one yeast for all of our whiskeys. So we played around with all those different ones and kind of settled on one that we felt like complemented our spirit the best coming off the still.
Talk to us for a moment, the delineation and separation of Kentucky bourbon, classic, and what makes a bourbon a bourbon?
So from a historical context, you know, as humans and Americans, we want to put history and things in a nice box with a ribbon on it and all the rest of it. But, you know, obviously history is always more convoluted than what people think. So, you know, if you look at from a historical context, those folks coming over from Scotland and Ireland, you know, they didn't have barley in the New World like they did in the Old World. So a lot of the rye distillers, like on the western frontier of Pennsylvania or Maryland, you know, they were producing rye whiskey. George Washington was the largest rye distiller in the country upon his death. Wow. And so anyway, as those settlers moved further south and kind of across the Appalachians, you know, they discovered Native American corn, and they realized that they could make a really quality distillate out of Native American corn. The first reference to bourbon is actually in the 1600s. Can't remember the guy's name. He's writing back to England, and he referred to he had made a wonderful corn brandy, and he named a corn variety. So, you know, it kind of morphed into slowly what became a corn-based distillate is the basis of bourbon and Tennessee whiskey. So as those folks moved from Virginia into Kentucky and from North Carolina into Tennessee, they were making corn-based distillates on the frontier, which eventually became bourbon and Tennessee whiskey. I mean, bourbon is America's official native spirit. Corn is America's official native grain. We have to use at least 51% corn in bourbon and Tennessee whiskey. So I don't know if that answers your question. And one little fact too, sometimes people in the industry in Tennessee get upset if I say this, but the only reason Tennessee whiskey is not bourbon is because Tennesseans don't want it to be.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, yeah.
So it could be.
And by definition, it is. Mm-hmm. So when we fill out our federal reports every month, we fill out 3 reports, and there's no box for Tennessee whiskey. The federal government considers Tennessee whiskey to be bourbon. It checks all the boxes for bourbon production with the 2 caveats. One is that before that whiskey goes into the barrel, it has to be filtered through sugar maple charcoal specifically, and then it has to be made in the state of Tennessee. So in essence, you make bourbon in the state of Tennessee before it goes into the barrel, a filtration through sugar maple charcoal.
I love it. So when somebody comes in to your retail space here,
mm-hmm.
what are the variables? What are the different options that somebody could purchase in a bottle?
So right now, I kind of look at our offerings. You know, we're very simple here, and I kind of take the stance of simple and honest. The reason I say that, so all of our Tennessee whiskey and our bourbon, we do those as bottle and bonds. Bottle and bond was the first Consumer Protection Act enacted by Congress in 1897. And what the Bottle and Bond Act stipulates is that the whiskey in the bottle had to be made by one single distiller or distillery, one single season, meaning either there's 2 seasons, January to June, July to December. And then the whiskey had to be aged for at least 4 years in a government bonded warehouse and bottled at 100 proof on the dot. So today, obviously, from a consumer protection standpoint, distillers aren't doing unscrupulous things like they were back in the late 1800s. What allows us, new distilleries, to do is to use that law as a statement of provenance. So consumers are a lot more educated now. So they want to know where the whiskey in the bottle is coming from. So we're taking all this time growing our corn, you know, making this whiskey ourselves. So we want consumers to know that we made the whiskey in the bottle from start to finish. So the bottle and bond allows us to do that. So we'll have a Tennessee whiskey bottle and bond, a bourbon bottle and bond, and then you'll also find Tennessee whiskey single barrel that we do and bourbon single barrel. And we do our single barrels as cask strength. So that's kind of the simple approach. So literally, if a barrel makes it into the single barrel, you know, category, then we literally dump that whiskey out, we run it through a debris filter, and it goes straight into the bottle. It's the most unadulterated version of whiskey that you can buy. So, and we go into the barrel at 110 proof. So coming out, we're around 115 to 107, somewhere around in there. So it makes these whiskeys approachable as cask strengths.
And you bring it down from dilution?
Well, actually, for the single barrel cask strengths, there's no dilution at all. So okay. When it comes out of the barrel, we do not touch it. We literally run it through a debris filter mm-hmm. just to clean it up. Mm-hmm. It's as pure whiskey as you can get, you know, from the barrel.
You're talking about rocket fuel.
Right. Well, you know, the definition of bourbon and Tennessee whiskey is, or one of the regulations is, you have to go into the barrel at 125 proof or less. Mm-hmm. So for us, we go in at 110. It's one of those nuanced things you were talking about. So before Prohibition, that barrel entry proof limit law was 110. And then science has shown that 110 proof has the best mix of alcohol and water to extract different types of wood sugars out of the barrel. So we feel like we're getting better use of the barrel at 110 proof. It's less efficient. We buy more barrels because we're packing less alcohol in the barrel, but we feel like it's being true to some of the notions that we think make a quality whiskey.
Okay, so you've had your whiskey in, say, in a barrel for 4 years.
Yes.
You bottle, and then you sell it. What if you libraried that bottle and just put it away? What happens
all the time? In the bottle, nothing really. I mean, so
best you can do is preserve.
It's a time capsule. So what we try to do here is we hold back at least 25% of every batch. So if we make 250 barrels of bourbon, we're holding 25% of that back for further aging. Eventually, I want our kind of standard age statement to be 7 years old. We have to get there. It's a, cash flow is, it's a new distillery, and we're family owned. You know, we don't have corporate money behind us. So
and how about, can't go 12 or 14 or 20.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah. You know, so we definitely are holding a lot of these barrels back for our oldest whiskeys right now are a little over 6 years. And so we're releasing most of our single barrels over 5 years old, closer to six. And it's really interesting to see the trajectory of that whiskey from a maturation standpoint. It's kind of exciting to see what's happening as oxidation is getting better and all the rest of it.
Unfortunately, our producer's given us the little lamb.
Absolutely. No worries.
To learn more about your world,
LeapersFortDistillery.com. We're on Instagram at LF Distillery and then Facebook, Leapers Fort Distillery. Lee Kennedy, Leapers Fort.
And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Leapers Fort, Tennessee. We'll see you here.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.
I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
I'll be turning 33 next Friday morning. Friday morning 15 years ago, my grandfather called me to his bedside, and he told me there was something I should know. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying. The land will save you, wait and see.
So I loaded up my car and moved to Denver to work a job and chase big city dreams. But I never found the life I really wanted till I came back home to Leaper's Fork, Tennessee. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see. It didn't hit me quite as hard then as those words come through today. But in the chaos all around me, I can still hear Grandpa say, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see.